the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
This morning we speak first with science journalist Asher Elbein, who explores a radical new theory that life's complexity may have emerged more than once on Earth. New evidence from billion-year-old fossils from Gabon, or Gabon, however you say it, that's that country along the Atlantic coast of Central Africa. These fossils have been discovered and could rewrite evolutionary history.
Then Park City resident Don Stenger, who has spent his life in the microchip business, talks about microchips as it relates to the coming AI revolution. We discuss the growing reliance on microchips throughout just about every major industry in the U.S. We also tackle the evolution of artificial intelligence in the U.S. and how it is interconnected with the microchip industry.
Stay tuned for these guests when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. Today on Cool Science Radio, we're joined by Asher Elbein, science journalist and author of Life's Big Bangs, the 10 Most Important Evolutions in the History of Life. In this fascinating exploration of Earth's biological turning points, Asher takes us from the very first spark of life through the rise of complex cells, animals, and ultimately us.
We'll talk with Asher about what makes an evolutionary Big Bang and how chance and catastrophe shaped the living world and what these ancient revolutions can teach us about the future of life on Earth. Asher, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the title. What do you mean by life's Big Bangs, and how did you decide which evolutionary events made your top 10 list?
Yeah, so looking at the way that we think about the Big Bang in terms of the universe, you know, we tend to think about these moments when, in the beginning there was nothing and then something happened and there was something, if you are looking at this in a sort of a scriptural way, I suppose. And so the topic here was really looking at this fundamental question of how did complex multicellular life of the kind that encompasses everything from algae to us, you know, these sort of like complex cells that want to band together and form larger organisms. How did these things begin? Because there was a long period of time in Earth's history, and we don't know exactly how long, where most of what lived on Earth did not look like us or anything like the sort of complex life that we see today. And so this question of where did we come from? Where did this kind of life that we all are and that we see around us every day, plants, algae, animals, how did this emerge? And there's a traditional answer to that question. And then there are sort of competing and somewhat more radical suggestions about that question. And that's really what the article is about.
Okay, so the traditional view is that evolution happens gradually. At least I think I have that right, that it kind of sort of is on a spectrum of evolution. But your book focuses on explosive turning points. And I'm curious, what defines a Big Bang moment in the history of life? Is there an example?
Yeah, so a great example in the article is really this question of a thing called the Francivillian, which is this period around 2.14 billion years ago, so really a really brutally long time ago, where if you, if you believe the researchers in question, there was sort of enough oxygen and enough nutrients to create a setting where complex, strange life could emerge, if you believe them. Some of the more, the more sort of like classic Big Bang moments that people tend to talk about are things like the Ediacaran period or the Cambrian period, somewhere around 700, 600 million years ago, where you start seeing the earliest animals with sometimes things with skeletons or sort of soft-bodied animals. Those are things that are very well established now and that people really understand and accept that those evolved around that time period. So there's a tremendous gulf between these two suggestions. And that is something that I think a lot of really interesting science is happening around, trying to work out what's happening in the roughly billion years or so between those two sort of suggested periods.
This is also interesting, Asher, because, you know, we talk about the Big Bang that happened about 13.8 billion years ago, the beginning of, you know, the universe as we know it. And then, I mean, you're talking about a period, a gap of about a billion years in there between 4 billion years ago and 2.5 billion years ago. But can you help us, you know, put together the pieces from 13.8 billion years ago when the Big Bang happens? You know, there's basically nothing there. And then there is heat. And then there is this dense point. Then there is, the universe expands and then matter starts to form. Help us out with that timeline into the area that you're talking about when life really first emerged as a single cell.
Yeah. So obviously, when we're talking about the Big Bang of the universe, we're talking about something that is a length of time that is really kind of hard to wrap your head around in terms of like how old a lot of this stuff is. So we're talking about, as you said, 13, you know, maybe almost 14 billion years ago, the universe comes into existence, and then, you know, it's quite a long period of time between then and the sort of development of the Earth from a, like, you know, sort of swirling space stuff around a young sun to, we're talking about 4.5 billion years ago, more or less. And actually, life on Earth seems to emerge pretty quickly when we're talking about these like vast geological timescales. You know, the earliest sort of like bacterial life on Earth shows up something like 3.9 billion years ago. So basically, almost as soon as the Earth is cool enough and there's enough water, life sort of starts cooking on Earth. And then there's, you know, some period of a couple of billion years, like roughly 2 billion years or so, where the vast majority of life on Earth is these single celled is like a little bit wrong, like these sort of like bacterial organisms that are, there's so many of them, and they're living in these incredibly hostile, like almost effectively alien version of Earth that looks almost nothing like what we would recognize today. But eventually they're pumping out, they're sort of developing the process of being able to unlock the energy of the sun through photosynthesis. They're breathing in carbon dioxide, they're pumping out oxygen, they're pumping out so much oxygen eventually that they change the entire atmosphere of the world into something that begins to look a lot more similar to the atmosphere that we see today. And this sort of like ongoing question is how high those oxygen levels got, how early the oxygen levels got that high, and whether that allowed for the emergence of complex life as early as 2.14 billion years ago. The conventional answer to this question, and still the best supported in terms of science, is that there were these really wild oxygen swings once that great oxygenation event happened around 2.5 billion years ago. And then eventually, like, the oxygen settled down and then began a long climb back up to the peak, which when you get to around 800, 700, 600 million years ago, million with an M, not million with a B, you start seeing these really much more oxygen-rich environments, and that's where we find the earliest uncontested complex life that looks like animals, that looks like algae, that looks like early plants. And there's a lot of like little multicellular things that go back as far back as 1.6 billion years ago. Some people would argue, try maybe even pushes almost as far back as 2 billion years ago. But the stuff that you see that everybody basically agrees is animals, plants, things like that, you know, all those like early big multicellular organisms, that's about 700 million years ago. So we're talking about spans of billions of years. But then the really central question is, how quickly on the planet Earth did these things, did life show up, and did these sort of like multicellular life show up?
Mm. That's fascinating. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science journalist Asher Elbein. He's written an article in the November issue of Scientific American titled Life's Big Bangs. And it's all about how complex life might have emerged hundreds of millions of years earlier than previously thought. Okay, Asher, I think it really lends to what we're so interested in now, modern day, is the viability of life on other planets, because it's so much what we're studying right now, what we're trying to find any traces of. When you look into this research, do you find that there are these parallels that give us insight to what might be going on in terms of life out there in the universe?
Yeah, certainly. So when I mentioned earlier that Earth, the sort of like the deep history of Earth is a very alien planet, I mean that almost literally in terms of if you think about some of these places like Mars, where there's these very different atmospheres, you know, there's very different levels of different kinds of gases in the atmosphere. And so this question of where life that we would recognize as such can live really is a very, it's an alive question, you might say. And it's an alive question because we know that life seems to have shown up pretty quickly on Earth when it was an incredibly hostile environment. So this question of what that means for life on other planets is a really relevant one. The question, the really difficult question is how will we recognize that life if we don't catch it being alive? By which I mean, if you send a probe to Mars and you happen to find liquid water and we happen to, you know, get a microscope, like a sort of remote microscope down there, we see little things squiggling around in the water. Okay, well, it's hard to explain that as anything but life. But what if you don't have that? What if you're looking for the traces of it? What if you're looking for fossils, essentially? How will you know that what you're looking at is the remnant of something that was alive versus a sort of something formed out of minerals, something that looks like it could have been alive, something that has this sort of like ambiguous chemistry? And so a lot of the work that's been happening on looking for sort of life on other planets has been looking at atmospheric chemistry, of trying to find these like signatures that are consistent with sort of living animals, or I shouldn't say even animals, just like life, you know, sort of like the processes of life. But when we're talking about areas like Mars, people tend to be looking at fossils. And so then there, the research that this scientist, Abdur El Albani, has been doing on these potential fossils from 1.6 billion years ago, in order to prove that they're fossils, even on Earth, when they're showing up way before you would think that they're supposed to, you have to look at the chemistry. You have to try and figure out if there's some way that you can lock down chemical signatures that show that something was alive or not. And if you can do that on Earth, it's going to be much easier to then try and apply that to other places in the galaxy.
Asher, you mentioned that Earth at one point, billions of years ago, was a pretty hostile environment. And I'm aware that there have been a few mass extinctions throughout Earth's history. And I know those can sound kind of destructive, but you show that they actually open doors for new forms of life. What surprised you the most about how life rebounds after a catastrophe?
I think it's really interesting the way that the nature of the catastrophe in question sort of impacts, sometimes literally, how things rebound. So when we're looking at the great oxygenation event, you know, the period in which that we, as, you know, oxygen-breathing breathing creatures think of as a sort of like a creative Big Bang for us, that was an incredibly destructive event in terms of Earth's early biodiversity. It forced a ton of bacteria that had been living very happily in these incredibly hostile to us environments into places that were significant, had like way less oxygen, you know, the sort of the deep mud, the sort of places where there's very little oxygen in the water. That's the places where many of those bacteria live. And so Sometimes like a wholesale restructuring of an ecosystem, you know, it's very harmful to many of the things that were living in that ecosystem. But there's usually a few survivors somewhere that have a whole new set of opportunities open to them that they can take advantage of. And maybe a more immediate or sort of famous version of this is, of course, the extinction of the dinosaurs was just a bad day cosmically. It was like there was no fundamental problem with that ecosystem the way that some other mass extinctions where there's been like massive amounts of CO2 being pumped into the air or sort of increasing desertification. Like one of the things that we now understand about the end Cretaceous by and large is that all of these ecosystems were very diverse and very flourishing and very healthy and dominated by large reptiles. And then there was an apocalyptic event, you know, an asteroid smacks into Mexico and there's a couple thousand years of darkness and acid rain and fires. And it's really bad. But when the sort of the dust settles, almost literally, the basic sort of like environment had not changed that much. But there were no longer these giant animals moving through. And so instead of having these very open plains and sort of patchy forests, you start getting the development of these closed canopy rainforests that we think of as very primordial looking or actually very recent. And the sort of like little mammals and little birds that were sort of marginal in the dinosaur ecosystem suddenly get a chance to step up and sort of reshape the ecosystem into something we would think looks modern and normal.
Okay, so you just mentioned the great oxygenation as probably being something that could have been harmful to the mud dwellers or the anaerobic life on Earth at that time, or even the Cambrian explosion. So these were changes that were driven by our planet itself. But is there a relationship that we can draw actually between maybe geology and biology in those moments of those catastrophic changes, or what we think of as catastrophic changes, but really just continue to evolve into different life?
Yeah, well, what's interesting about the Great Oxygenation Event is that is, so far as we understand it, that is actually an almost entirely biologically driven event. Bacteria unlocked power via the sun and via breathing in carbon dioxide and excreting in sort of like passing oxygen as a byproduct in that process. And oxygen is a poisonous gas. It's not a poisonous gas to us unless you get too much of it, although you can poison yourself with oxygen. So in a sense, the bacteria that were pumping out vast amounts of oxygen did poison themselves to death, or at the very least, into a much more marginal role in the environment. And the organisms that could handle higher oxygen levels were the ones that sort of succeeded there. So there is this kind of, there can be this relationship where I think as we're all perhaps somewhat aware now, living organisms on a sufficient scale and with sufficient ability to do so can cause tremendous changes to the environment that sometimes those organisms cannot then themselves survive.
Yeah. So going back to L. Albani's, is Francevillian, is that the
yes.
correct pronunciation, Francevillian fossils, what makes a fossil then? What is the determination that, yes, this is a fossil or no, this isn't?
Well, that's the billion-year question, I guess, is if you ask L. Albani, who... for those who have not yet had a chance to read the article, essentially the article focuses on El Albani's investigations into this 1.6 billion-year-old site in the African nation of Gabon called Francevillian. And he has found these structures, these little sort of sparkly structures that he argues are the fossils of sort of strange early multicellular organisms, things like sort of slime molds or kind of colony living single-celled organisms. The problem is that many researchers have looked at the sort of specimens and argued, well, these look sort of accumulations of minerals to us. But then this question of how do you prove that something is an accumulation of minerals when in order for something to fossilize, it has to mineralize. That's how the process of fossilization works. So then you have to say, you know, when you're looking at recognizable organisms, you're looking at, we know what the microstructure of a bone looks like. And so if you pick up a bone at a time period when we understand there to have been bones, you know, somewhere 300, 400 million years ago, you can say, okay, well, this is probably a bone. And even sometimes people get it wrong, right? People pick things up and think that they might be fossils and they're not. This is not something where it's, you're an idiot if you make the mistake of thinking something is a fossil or isn't a fossil. This can be tricky even when you're looking at anatomy that we understand very well. And this is anatomy that we don't understand, if it's anatomy at all. So El-Albani and his colleagues have been working, I think, very hard to try and find ways of proving that what they have are fossils. So they've looked at the chemistry. There's an aspect of cell sort of biology and metabolism where living organisms of our kind, of like eukaryotes, don't really like heavy metals. They're like, things like arsenic are quite dangerous and damaging to us. So if you look at living organisms, we tend to have lighter isotopes in us. You know, the heavier the isotope, the less we like it, the more we want to get it out of our body or sequester it. And so El-Albani and his colleagues have looked at some of these things that they argue are fossils, and they have demonstrated, and this has been backed up by some other researchers who are not in their lab, that they seem to have lighter isotopes in them than the surrounding rock. So that's indicative of something, or it's at least consistent with the idea that these things might have been alive. Is that the same thing as being proof? That's a philosophy of science question that just gets into, you know, the earlier and the further away a set of potential fossils is from anything that is widely recognized, the higher the burden of proof is going to be, and the harder it is to get people to go along with it, just because it's such a radical suggestion.
So how in the scientific community are these quote unquote fossils being received? I mean, has anything like these fossils been found in anywhere else other than Gabon?
Not yet. And part of the reason for that is that the specific kinds of rocks that you need in order to preserve these very soft body, very fragile organisms are, you need rocks that are sedimentary rocks with really nice preservation that have not been buried and effectively like cooked for, you know, millions to billions of years of pressure and heat that just wipe clean any of the potential fossils that might be in them. But that being said, most researchers, I think, still look at this very skeptically and are not very friendly to the idea that these are what El-Albani and his colleagues say that they are. That being said, for this piece, I spoke to a number of researchers, and some of them, while still being fairly skeptical, are now, I think, increasingly open to the idea that they either might be what El-Albani says they are, or at the very least, that our understanding of when some of these things that we think of as very geologically recent, like complex multicellular organisms, that only showed up 600, 700 million years ago, there's increasing friendliness to the idea that that may have to be pushed back. And one of the other interesting aspects of this is that there's a lot of work that's being done looking at genetics to try and figure out the last common ancestor of all eukaryotic life. And that, if you trace that back, that goes back to around 1.9 billion years ago, which is still well after these supposed fossils in the Franz Fillion. But if you ask the question, was this an independent experiment with multicellularity or sort of with eukaryotes or something like eukaryotes, these sort of like complex cells developing in a window when that was something that the world, the setting of the world was friendly to, and that entire lineage didn't survive to the modern day, they would be undetectable in these kinds of genetic, sort of like genetic backtracking, because the genetic backtracking depends on the last common ancestor of things that are alive today. Things that didn't make it to today, we wouldn't be able to detect in that fashion. So it's an interesting problem. It raises the possibility that potentially some of these things that we think maybe only happened once could potentially have happened more than once in Earth's history. It's just, again, the question of, how do you prove what is an interesting suggestion and make it into scientific fact?
So speaking of life today, if we look across, you know, the last several billion years and the last big 10 big bangs, what patterns or lessons do you think are most relevant to life on Earth today, especially in the age of rapid climate change that we're facing?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think the most relevant lesson is that life can be incredibly flexible and sort of able to bounce back pretty quickly. But that is not the same thing as saying these sorts of mass extinction events are no big deal. Because for everything that's caught up in them that doesn't survive, they are the big deal. That's the end. There's nothing more. And nothing more can come from those lineages because they've died out. You know, if the Franz-Villian fossils are fossils, then that likely was an independent, thriving experiment with multicellularity that got brought to a crashing halt because the world changed. And the fact that, you know, all of the sort of diversity that we see today did later emerge does not mean necessarily that something equally or more interesting might not have emerged if the world hadn't changed and the Franz-Villian fossils, if that's what they are, had been able to sort of get the same runway that our lineage did. So I think it is really remarkable to consider how flexible life as a broad category can be, while also really treasuring the life that we have around us and that we don't want to vanish, just in hopes that something interesting that none of us will ever get to see will show up in 100 million years.
Well, it is really interesting. And I think that your article kind of points out, and this conversation is pointing out for me, that it's as much about evolution of life as it is evolution of science. And mm-hmm. The photos of the Franz-Villian fossils are so interesting. Some of them I would pass by and never, or I would look at and I would never say, oh, that's a fossil. And others seem clearly like fossils.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting, huh?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. So I had the chance to go to Poitiers in France, which is where the sort of the Franz-Villian material is maintained in El Albani's lab. And, you know, some of them don't really look like anything I would recognize as a fossil. Doesn't mean that they are, doesn't mean that they aren't. It's just it's hard to look at and sort of gloss. But there is one set of them, which are, I wonder if these are the ones you're referring to, Lynn, where they look like almost like a sand dollar or a jellyfish sort of imprinted in the sort of the black shale. And it's really hard to look at those and not think, well, that really looks like a fossil. That doesn't look like any mineral accretion that I've ever seen. Again, doesn't mean it's not, but it does mean that if it is a mineral accretion, that's something that is a very strange mineral accretion and is something that will have to be proved itself, right? There's this question of who has to prove their theories, and traditionally, the person with the more radical theory is the person who has to prove it, and the people who are with the sort of general consensus are able to say, well, we're in the position to judge, and we're in the position to assess when this is enough to convince us. But also, sometimes the arguments that are being made from the sort of position of consensus don't necessarily match the facts on the ground. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong, but it does mean sometimes that they also need to go and like prove their hypothesis rather than just choosing not to talk about it.
Well, our guest today has been science journalist Asher Elbein, and his article in the November issue of Scientific American is titled Life's Big Bangs. It's really mind-blowing and very interesting. So Asher, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg. My guest this segment is Don Stenger, a local Park City resident who is the principal and founder of Transnational Group, LLC. Now, Don grew up in Southern California and received his bachelor's in economics at Pomona College in Claremont, where he played football and rugby. You don't want to mess with Don here. And in 1967, he joined IBM in Riverside. And after holding a variety of sales and marketing positions, Don became IBM branch manager in Central Missouri in 1981. And in 1983, he became director of marketing and business development for IBM China and moved his entire family to Tokyo, Japan. And in that role, he led the team that conducted an executive briefing for the Great Hall of the People in Beijing for the People's Republic of China, in the cabinet, and launched the Chinese language personal computer. During his time in China, he worked closely with Zhao Zemin, who was the head of China's computer industry. And then Zhang, of course, became the leader of the People's Republic of China in 1989. I guess Don was really rubbing some serious elbows back then. He then returned to the United States in 1986 and led the international marketing for IBM. In 2000, he founded the Transnational Group, which provides business and marketing strategy with a focus of international companies, including Fujitsu, SAS Institute, and Georgia Pacific. Now, Don enjoys fly fishing, downhill skiing, fingerstyle acoustic guitar. I don't know what that is. Hopefully we'll find out. He serves on the boards of Rotary Club of Park City, High Country Fly Fishers, and Boot Up. He lives with his wife, Bettina, in Park City, Utah. Don, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It is such a pleasure to be here face-to-face in the studio with you. Now, I've got to start off by just asking, what is a microchip? I mean, we hear the term microchip all the time. Small chip, I guess. What is it?
Well, Scott, it's great to be here. And if we're not going to talk about fly fishing, we're not going to talk about acoustic guitar. So a microchip is also called the integrated circuit, a small electronic device made from semiconductor material, typically silicon, that integrates a large number of tiny electronic components to perform specific functions, such as processing, storing, or transmitting data. But I thought it would be more instructive to go back and talk about the evolution of the microchip and how did we get the basics of it. So it goes back, this history story goes back to 1703 when we had Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, who actually invented the binary numbering system and how the binary numbering systems could be used in mathematics. He was a German mathematician.
I'm sorry, Don, did you say 1703?
Stay tuned, Scott. And then fast forward 150 years later, and we end up with a guy named George Boole. George was an Englishman. He was a philosopher and mathematician. And he created the logic of the microchips through Boolean algebra and Boolean logic. And then you have to go another 90 years or so, and then you meet a guy named Claude Elwood Shannon. He's known as the father of information technology. What did he do? Well, when he was a graduate student at Caltech in 1937, he wrote his thesis on how you could take a binary system and Boolean logic and implement that in hardware, in switches. And again, it's a binary way on or off, right? So that was the basis for what happened with microchips later. But before that, we got the invention of a really key component, or the transistor, which was Jack Kilby and Robert Noyce in the late 50s invented the integrated circuit and the transistor. And from that point, Robert Boyce co-founded Intel, which is our domestic, one of our domestic important players in the microchip industry. And he co-founded Intel with a guy named Gordon Moore. Gordon Moore is known for 1965. He said, we're going to double chips on a substrate. And then he revised that in 1975. And until 2015, every 2 years, the number of transistors on a substrate doubled. 2015, the physics caught up with us, and the heat and the density caused the slowdown in that progress. So that's kind of the background of where do we get the binary system, the on-off switches, where did we get the logic, how did we get to where we are with integrated circuits today?
I kind of feel like we just got a graduate course level in microchips and the history, but
I'm just a humble scribe.
Humble, well, and knowledgeable, I will say. But okay, so you've told us what the history of the microchips are. What exactly are they? Like, how are they made? Are they just tiny little pieces of sand, or what's a microchip?
So it starts with one of the most prevalent substances on Earth, silica sand. The sand is melted and it's made into a what's called an ingot. It's a very pure cylinder of silicon. And that is sliced into very thin wafers. And those wafers are the basis for the process, which is a very complex process. But basically, it through a period or a series of etchings and photoelectric etchings and patterns on that silicon wafer, we create various electronic circuits that process information, store information, and it depends on how dense the chip is, but I'll talk later about how dense we really get to with the state of the art. But it's a very complex process. It needs to be in a very clean environment, 1,000 times cleaner than in your operating rooms. Got to have special lights around it. It's very complex.
Who's making these things?
So we have several types of players in this space. Intel and Samsung are what are called integrated, and which means they design and manufacture and do the sales of their microchips. Then we have the fabless players, and a lot of people talk about NVIDIA as you know, they make all the chips. No, NVIDIA designs the chips. They don't do any manufacturing. They design the chips, and the next set of players are the fabs, or the fabricators, or the manufacturers. And the biggest one is in Taiwan, Taiwan Semiconductor, and they make 60% or more of all chips manufactured in the world, and they make over 90% of the most sophisticated chips. And they're just they're investing $160 billion in Phoenix, and beginning to ship very high-tech microchips out of Phoenix.
Wow, okay, so...
And there's one more. There's electronic design companies, which are the software that NVIDIA uses, for example, to design their chips. That's Synopsys, Cadence, and other companies.
So, okay, so we've got several companies that design, manufacture. NVIDIA, who I mean, that... Obviously, everybody's heard of NVIDIA. It's definitely on fire, right?
Yeah. But I hope you bought the stock.
I wish. How are these chips used today in our modern computers?
Well, you know, people say, how important are microchips? Well, I say, when's the last time you misplaced your phone? And how did you feel about that? I know when
actually not since yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. And when your laptop doesn't work, how do you feel about that? So, you know, microchips are everywhere. They're in your appliances. They're in your automobile. Depending on the density of the chips, that would be the different applications. At the most dense, most sophisticated, and we're talking about nanometers, your human hair is 100,000 nanometers. And we're talking about the most sophisticated chips now are down to 3 or 4 nanometers. And the reason that density is important is because the more dense and the more circuits you can put in a specific space, the faster the chip is. And of course, as I mentioned, it does turn off some heat, so you got to deal with that. But your laptop is probably in a 10 to 14 nanometer microchip. AI graphical processing units that NVIDIA is using, that people are using with AI, are going to be down in the 5 to 4 nanometer size, which means they're very fast. So there's these types of microchips are important to think about. Some are logic and the others are memory. So the logic chips are central processing unit types or graphical processing units. There's also something that's called neuro processing unit, which is trying to kind of mimic the human brain. There's also ASICs, which are application-specific integrated circuits, and those are specific task programs built into the hardware, and those are like the self-driving cars are using ASICs processors.
All right, so you brought up the dreaded AI, which we really, I'm telling you, it has become such a hot topic here on Cool Science Radio. And we really, almost every episode or every show, we factor some sort of AI into our conversations. What is the current role of microchips right now in artificial intelligence? And I'm asking this because I'm going to ask a follow-up question about quantum computing. So let's start with artificial intelligence and microchips and what's going on in that.
Microchips are the engine that runs large language modeling, that when you go on to your chatbot, you're interacting with an inference engine that is built on a large language model. All of that is dependent on parallel processing. When NVIDIA first designed their first graphical processing unit, that was for gaming, because gaming, you know, processes a lot of video and there's a lot of parallel processing. So they were very fortunate to be architecting these because they're right in the sweet spot. So a lot of graphical processing units. There's also something called a tensor processing unit that Google developed, which is closer to the inference side of things. So it's the engine that drives artificial intelligence. Now, full disclosure, I'm a skeptic, okay? When I start hearing people talking about the various stages, I see various stages that could be possible. I see them processing large amounts of data, but garbage in, garbage out. You know, without editing, without, you know, error correction, it's garbage in, garbage out. I think a lot of these models are like a little puppy dog. You ask the question, they want to please you. They're going to give you an answer whether it's right or not. Now, will that change over time? Yes, but the amount of hype is amazing. And the data center investment, Sam Altman, who's head of OpenAI, just announced they're planning to build data centers to the tune of $1 trillion a year. Now, I'm an econ guy, right? So how do I make money if I'm investing $1 trillion a year? I need an incredible number of big revenue streams. So I'm a bit of a skeptic on this.
Wow. Okay. So you talked about parallel processing. I don't even know what that is.
It's two processors or more processors working on the same workload at the same time.
In parallel.
Simultaneous and parallel. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to your skepticism on AI. We had on a couple months ago another Parkite, a young man here who works in artificial intelligence for an online learning company. And he also alluded to the fact that AI is a puppy, right? AI wants to please you. And so sometimes it leads to hallucinations, right?
Exactly.
Makes up an answer because it wants to make up it wants to give you an answer. It might not be the right answer, but it wants to give you an answer. But he was talking, and I apologize that I don't have the right terminology in my head. Maybe you have it. But he was saying that you can actually train AI so that when you get the bad answers, you can kind of tell AI, no, that's not right. And it can, you know, oh, okay, maybe I need to, you know, put that to the side. So artificial intelligence, and again, we had somebody else on from Google talking about AI, and he hates the term artificial intelligence. He refers to it as machine learning, which I think is probably a more accurate statement. But he was talking about how it is getting better, it is getting closer, but there's still a ways to go before it really does learn what is accurate.
So I totally agree with that point of view. You have self-referential models now that you can teach to be less error-prone. No question about it. My skepticism is around the amount of power, which is really the gating factor right now. There are chips sitting idle because there's not enough electricity. I mean, they're talking about running 1 gigawatt data centers, which is what Dallas-Fort Worth uses in a year, right? So I'm skeptical about the data center side. I'm also skeptical about the move towards artificial general intelligence, which is usually defined as reaching the intelligence of a typical, you know, quote unquote, person. Now, there's now some benchmarks coming out, and they're actually scoring ChatGPT, which is OpenAI's chatbot, on how many of the characteristics of an average person does it meet. And it, based on this benchmark, 57% right now. But I mean, it's a very subjective, but it's interesting if you try to analyze what is a person and how would you replicate the average person? It's, you know, I mean, I don't know.
You're sitting across from one.
That's true.
Put me in the
you're
test.
You're not average, Scott. Come on.
I'm sure it would score very average. Well against me.
Yeah, okay.
Now, going back to the theory of the puppy who wants to please, it feels like when it gives you a bad answer, you roll up the newspaper, smack it on the nose, and say, bad dog, no biscuit.
That's the metaphor.
Okay. You I like it.
Yeah.
I like the metaphor.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's morph. For lack of a better term. Yeah, I know. I see. I'm glad this is just radio because nobody can see the expression on your face because you know what I'm about to ask. We're going to talk about, of course, you know, we had Mathieu Kaku on recently.
I listened to him.
Right. Oh, good. And talking about quantum mechanics and quantum computation. Can you you want to weigh in on that, Don?
Well, I would never contradict anything that Dr. Kaku said. I think he was right on the money. The thing that's hard to grasp is just the whole concept of quantum mechanics. The concept that if I do something here, it gets, because of entanglement, it happens over there. Now get your head around that. That's where we're going to use quantum computing. Why? We talked about parallel processing. How cool is that if I do one thing over here and it automatically gets replicated somewhere else? The other aspect that he talked about is when we talk about binary systems and digital integrated circuits, we're talking about on and off switches and combinations of on and off switches.
Zeros and ones.
Logic and create memory. But in this case, a quantum bit, a qubit, a quantum bit, has multiple status. It can be multiple things. It can be a one or a zero, or it can be something in between, as Dr. Kaku said. So what you have, although you have to do this at cryogenic, you know, at zero, close to zero Kelvin. So the IBM systems, they run inside of a refrigerator. So I don't know if he didn't mention that, I guess. But I mean, we're talking about some serious environmental things that have to happen in order for you to be able to get quantum computing to work. But anyway, so you have these multiple states, which means you could have in a same amount of space, which is what the speed is all about, right? More things and more space. You're going to get more work done in the same space, all right? So it's huge opportunity, but there's something called the Hawthorne effect. Did you ever study that in business school? When you measure something, you change the state of it. So that you can use that in business. If you really, you know, if you're studying, doing a survey, what you change the situation. And quantum mechanics, quantum computing, if you go to check the state of a quantum qubit, over time, it deteriorates and you end up with errors. So what NVIDIA has done is they're now taking supercomputers and attaching them to quantum, and the main thing for the computer, which is called NQV-Link, is I'm going to do error correction to make sure that what comes out of the quantum. And I'm using a digital computer to do that. So we're seeing this marriage of supercomputers and quantum computers to address the main issue, which is the fragility of a qubit. Because when you measure it, you degrade it. So you end up with errors. But I mean, the potential is huge. And I'm not skeptical about this. I'm just saying there's a lot of things that have to be done to make quantum computing really happen.
How close are we?
Well, I'm reading simulations now. We're simulating them. We're not that close, I don't think. But maybe NVIDIA will come up with a solution that makes it closer. You know, you can't discount technology, can you, Scott? I mean,
No, and I'm not a business guy. That's why I'm doing cool science radio and not cool business radio.
You're a business guy, too.
You know, I'm fascinated by the concept that by observing something, you change something. So that's kind of a cool
effect.
Thing, too. Yeah, the Hawthorne effect. I just learned something new here on Cool Science Radio. Okay, Don, we have just 1 minute left. You want to wrap up with something?
I just think this is an exciting time to be alive, you know? And being a techie, I just can't get enough of what's happening. I watch podcasts. I just find it interesting that some people are so oblivious to the impact of AI, socioeconomic, which is not the such, but that's huge. What's going to happen with artificial intelligence models replacing various jobs? I think that's a big issue.
Well, I kind of hope it doesn't replace mine. I'm enjoying it.
You can't be replaced.
Don Stenger, thank you so much for being here. This has just been wonderful. Thank you for joining us live in studio.
My pleasure.
What a treat.
It's a blast. I've had a great time.
Okay. Well, you're just going to have to take me fly fishing.
Yes, sir.
Anytime. All right. Thanks again for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode and past episodes on KPCW's website or on the new KPCW app. And if you liked this episode, please rate us and share it with a friend. And if you have suggestions for a future guest or topic or for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And you've been listening to KPCW Radio at Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County.